Hello, my name is Liz Booth, and I am the editor of Africa Ahead.
And I am Cass Hanser, former group head, underwriting and claims at Continental Reinsurance.
Together, we welcome you to Insurance Matters, a new insurance-inspired podcast by Africans, for Africans, and dealing with African issues. Join us as we explore real-life stories, true and sometimes surprising ones, inspired by and linked to the continent's insurance sector, a sector that we feel is often overlooked when we think about Africa. Each episode will have its own, sometimes unexpected theme. Plus, we'll be joined by some renowned experts whose deep knowledge of the sector will help us connect the dots and to find out why insurance is likely to have more relevance to our day-to-day lives here in Africa than we might think. With elections in Kenya, presidential elections in Nigeria too, and with the continued threat of strikes and riots in South Africa, the continent appears to be on the edge of turmoil. But how real are those risks of politically motivated violence, and what can be done to protect ourselves, both as individuals and as businesses? To discuss this, we have Mahesh Mahavji, Managing Director at Loss Adjuster McLarens. Hi, Mahesh. How are you today? Are you well?
Hi, Liz. Thank you for inviting me. Yes, I'm wonderfully well. Today is slightly warmer than it normally is for Nairobi. We're glad to be here.
Well, that's good because I think Kaz is cold down in South Africa and I'm cooking up in Europe. So nice to hear that. Obviously, we're talking about political violence today, and it does seem to have become the hot topic of 2022. You know, just with all the strikes and things going on across the world. You know, what's keeping you awake at night? Do you think in Africa that these risks are a likely eventuality?
It's a good question. Africa is a large, very large continent. And there are so many diverse interests and peoples and everything and different economies, different ways of thinking. So we cannot generalize that. We can be specifics. I mean, I'll give an example of Kenya where I have lived. I was born here, work here and worked here. And yes, we have issues, but we have, for the last 30 odd years, Kenya has been going through a continuous change on the political scene. There have been some troubles, but I feel that the security and the goodwill of the people, population, inhabitants, has often stopped a serious problem developing, particularly in Kenya. We have had our problems, yes. We have had our internal strifes, yes. But somehow or the other, the government, the authority, and the security forces have managed to contain the situation to an extent where we have not had serious problems. Yes, we have had economic issues, financial issues, but we have managed to get through without the country actually going through the turmoil that other African countries have experienced. The other countries within the region that I've seen here, it is other than the fracas we have in Sudan, South Sudan, and Ethiopia, an ongoing issue, it's been fairly okay. Not been that destructive. So yes, they give some sleepless nights closer to when we are having the elections, post-elections, when we wait for the results, and all sorts of rumors, and because of the social media, the internet, everything going through, a lot of friction and attrition is created by that. But in Kenya, I feel comfortable that things are under control, until obviously if they do go out of control, but never to the extent where there's serious worries. Because remember, Kenya had a coup in 1981. We had multipartyism came in 1991. That came in 1991. Then we had new parties coming in, the change of the regime in 1997. And barring a few problems, we managed to get through. We had a bit of a problem in 2007 and 2008, which was contained. Yes, there was a lot of financial losses and everything. But generally, the authorities managed to keep the situation under control and we carried on, and this is where we are today. But there's a general more maturity among the public and the population as to what it is.
I think on a slightly different perspective, even if we start looking at what is put out globally on these global political risks or terrorism risk maps, you'll generally see, and I repeat general, because it's a bit of a generalization, that the African continent in particular stands out. If you look at the color coding, you'll generally see that it's Africa as a continent that has these perceived to be higher exposures. Now, how they play out and to what extent, what severity, I think is what Mahesh is hinting at, and whether it can be easily contained. But for South Africa, since our democracy in 1994, I think last year, July, those riots, in some quarters referred to as an insurrection, really were mind-boggling. As citizens of the country, we were astounded to see that kind of mayhem unfold. And so I would like to think that if we're not careful on our continent, we've got powder keg situations that arises from the conditions of poverty, inequality, and in particular unemployment and unemployment amongst the youth. I think those are the realities that we have to face and recognize and see how best we then contain these from necessarily unfolding and causing undue strife, not only socially, but also economically.
So, so you're sort of saying really that the economic drivers could be more of a trigger point perhaps than maybe elections, and that, you know, unemployment is going to be the big issue.
The politics is, we're looking for the trigger point. That's the trigger point. But what is underlying is exactly that. People are unhappy. People are hungry. And so this is what we need to be careful of.
And presumably, though, all those things that you've just said, that fuels terrorism, doesn't it? Because that's the other half of this, is, you know, the terror threat across Africa, whether that's good. I don't know, Mahesh, you know, is the terror threat perceived to be rising in Nairobi at the moment? I know there's often warnings going out to the local populations about concerns.
No, actually, I've not seen that. I mean, the attack that we had in two, three places, the first one we had in the 80s when the popular hotel was bombed in the 1980-1981, then everything was quiet until we had Westgate and later Dusit. But we are very close to... Our neighbors are Somalia, and Somalia and Kenya have always had a sort of a semi-cordial relationships. And often issues have blown out of proportions to the extent that we have had this. But in Kenya, for me, I find it astounding how adequately the security forces and the intelligence managed to contain what I think is an extremely dangerous situation. But they seem to contain it. They seem to know what they are doing. And we have a fairly large population of Somalis in this country who have settled down and who are doing extremely well. So the threat is always there. Let's not keep that aside. It's always there. But how well it is managed. You see, it's like when we talk about the people. The maturity of the people in this country, in Kenya, is always something that has surprised me and impressed me, because we have gone through some very hard times, but they managed to control it. What I think makes a big difference is the maturity of the leaders, how they would like to take their positions in the event they lose power or their seat or their positions in politics. Now, that, I think, is the main fundamental that keeps Kenya in line. Having said that, remember, Kenya has been attacked at least three times on terror attacks, which is more than other countries. And there's been a lot of loss of life as well as property.
Absolutely. I mean, and obviously, you know, across the continent, there are attacks, aren't there? You know, you've got Al-Shabaab in East Africa, and, you know, you've got the militants Boko Haram in West Africa, who've attacked in lots of different countries. But again, as you say, it tends to be parts of the country, not the whole country, and contained to some degree. I mean, do you think the authorities learn lots of lessons, particularly after things like Westgate and then obviously Dusit as well? Do you think, I mean, the Dusit attack seemed don't like to use the word controlled, but just seemed to be much more contained very, very quickly, you know, than perhaps Westgate was. Do you think the authorities had learned some of the lessons from that?
Very quickly, you can see that, because Westgate, as it happened, we heard about it. It heard in the when it broke out in the afternoon, and how it actually spiraled into such a huge problem is something we never really understood. And but from that, then what happened at Dusit? In fact, what was happening at Dusit, I could actually see it from my office. I could see the helicopters, everybody hovering around the place, social media coming in with all sorts of information. It was actually on real time. We could see what was going on there. And the coordination on that one was absolutely fantastic. Yes, there was a bit of damage, loss of life was always there, but having handled that particular case, I could realize why so many young people died in that, because of the manner the whole thing unfolded. But the reaction by the security forces and the coordination between themselves was remarkable. Yes, there's plenty of property damage, but they managed to contain the loss of life. So certainly we can say they've learned a huge amount from what happened with Westgate. But there's a lot of influence, a lot of help coming in. There's a lot of resources being put into the system and into the security forces and by people themselves, private and public, to ensure that if something happens, the damage is limited.
You were heavily involved, weren't you, in the kind of aftermath at Westgate in terms of managing some of the insurance claims off the back of that. I mean, do you think the insurance industry, has it changed how the insurance industry looks at PVT risks in Africa and how you manage those risks, do you think?
Remember, Kenya has, how do I put it? It's got an infrastructure. It's got a base from which it works on. If you look at surrounding countries, Uganda, Tanzania, Burundi, Rwanda, Congo, South Sudan, Ethiopia, Eritrea, those countries have not developed to the level that Kenya has, and more, and even less as far as the insurances go. So what happened with Westgate, because we have a large industrial commercial base here compared to the size of the country and the development that we have so far, people picked it up very quickly. They learned very quickly of the importance of that. And particularly where you have public places like shopping malls, cinemas, or places where lots of people congregate, like hotels, where you have foreign tourists, all of them took some extremely excellent precautions to try and contain a problem if it manifests. And then they also, besides enhancing the internal security, they also looked at the insurance aspect, and most of them, for a number of years after the attack on Westgate, kept their PVT insurances. And then because they thought the risk and the problem had died down, they sort of took it away. Now what happens is generally it is picked up towards election time. So if an election is coming in, and yes, during election time, we expect issues to arise. It is possible that factories, buildings, offices, houses, maybe no, but places might be attacked, as it happened in 2007 when the Kisumu, where I did a huge amount of work, it was very badly damaged. A lot of businesses were burnt out. There was a lot of looting and stealing and lots of problems there. And from that, they learned. But that was on the political side. On the terrorism side, it tends to go down after some time. But politics, the moment there's an election or something that comes up, like what we are having now, generally there's a tendency for a spike on PVT insurance to come up, which has happened every single time. So yes, it does sort of dovetail into that.
Yeah, from South African perspective, for the region, I'd like to take a perspective that given these dynamics, for us on the insurance side, when we deal with risks, the flip side, of course, is opportunity. We all know that. And so I think there's an opportunity, especially when the insurance sector is looking to see how it can better place itself and look for new products to provide and assist economies and society by and large, that here's a good reason to be looking to see how we could better sell the position of providing the cover, especially for retail, personal lines as well. Motor vehicles is a big issue. And in the southern region, there are many countries, and I'll give you an example to make my point, Botswana, where incidental property that happens to leave Botswana and go out into, say, the South African area, or motor vehicles that travel into the South African region are not covered for political violence, terrorism exposures. And why is this the case? So there's a huge opportunity for the insurance sector to get together and provide the necessary coverage as an increased, enhanced feature to the existing product lines that they provide. So I'd like to focus on the opportunities that avail themselves now, and that there's no protection gap, because that's our purpose. Our purpose is to understand where the risks and the exposures are to lives, to people, to commercial business, and see how we can better deal with that and have that risk transferred.
One of the problems is, though, isn't it, that you know, because that's, as you say, the aim is to stop that, close that protection gap. But one of the problems in PVT at the moment is the way that the rates are skyrocketing. I mean, they're up sort of 30-40% this year, aren't they? And then when you look at, if there was to be a claim, the rebuild costs are going up too. So the danger is that people may have bought a policy, but then find themselves underinsured because the valuations were done before the supply chain crisis globally and before the rebuild costs started escalating. So I'm just wondering, you know, how are insurers handling that? And I mean, Mahesh, from your point of view, you must see those rebuild costs in particular, because when you're handling a claim, that's when you're coming in and looking at the costs. And I mean, are you finding there's a mismatch between what people think they're going to get in terms of cover and what they are actually getting?
On particular policies or only on PVT policies?
Well, I think, I mean, obviously it's a more general question, but I think I'm just wondering, obviously PVT is where there seems to have been a particular issue this year with the Ukraine war, and rates have been going up ever since that, haven't they? Which obviously has got little to do with Africa, but seems to be impacting the African markets regardless. And I know capacity, because a lot goes through the London market of this type of insurance, doesn't it? And the London market is putting rates out. People are pulling out of the cover. There's less capacity in the market. So I'm just wondering if PVT is an example of where the insurance industry has to be very mindful with its clients that there isn't a gap.
Well, that's a very good question. Here, the situation on the ground, but the practicalities of this insurance are multifaceted. But let's look at the main buyers of this policy. These are all the big industrial concerns, the big malls, supermarkets, where the risk factors are much higher than the retail areas. The retail areas do get hit, but not to the extent as would happen for larger concerns. So now, the price, the premium has risen, but what I did find between what I did initially at Westgate and what I'm doing now is the broadening of the scope of cover that is provided by current policies. Yes, most of the underwriting is done on the London market. Yes, the premiums are quite high. Yes, discounts are given if the security precautions and measures taken, where I've done some risk assessment for a couple of the larger shopping areas, and they have done a lot of work to ensure that things are in place. The larger factories have taken consideration about putting in deterrence, physical and both physical and otherwise, put in extra guards and whatever to ensure that there is adequate security. But you can't have a security against a large mob that comes in. But they've taken all that into account. So what happens is when the premiums are being done, all these factors are taken in. So you might get some discounts, but the main buyers of this are the larger businesses. So they will pay even if the price has increased, whatever it takes, because they cannot afford to have their decades and generations of work wiped out. So they will carry on. But the impact may well be on the smaller businesses, which is what happened in Westgate. A lot of those shops that were plundered and destroyed, they did not have that cover because they never thought it would come into play. But the larger ones, the supermarkets and the jewelry and watch shops and everyone, most of them had that because the risk factors were there. So on balance, even if the price goes up, the demand is not going to go down. And most of the people who buy this insurance know the risk that they have. Yes, I know personally a lot of people who have a lot of property, houses, apartments, and buildings and whatever, but they're not insured against this. In fact, most of the cars that were damaged or destroyed in Westgate did not have that cover. Why? Because they never thought about it. It never crossed their minds that something like this would happen. So on the smaller risk, where the premiums may be a few percentage points, they're not taken up. So on to the question that you raise, yes, if the price goes up, they broaden the cover, they're doing that, but the premium will be paid. It means a smaller profit, but at least the business is protected.
But if I can come in on that, I think there are two important points for me that need mentioning. And that is, I think it's incumbent for the insurance industry recognizing this particular area where there's a huge opportunity, but to do the right thing in that the scope of coverage, and these are quite varied in that there's the very wide political risk insurance, and then there's narrower forms of cover, as with all things insurance. But there's a lot of fuzziness around the definitions of what is covered. Even terrorism. Under certain circumstances, governments may feel it's terrorism. And under different interpretations by the general society, it may be regarded just as an uprising, as a riot. And then we start playing games. And I'd really like to think that the insurance industry owes it to itself to be very clear on what covers are being provided, spell out the terms very succinctly, and then for the kinds of coverage for the enterprises, the SMEs that Mahesh is talking about, that scope of cover is best designed to suit their particular needs. Is it just the assets, property, stock damage, and then a bit of business interruption? But to make sure that we can deal with that protection gap. And then as far as the pricing is concerned, it of course has to be affordable. And insurers are best at that game, because once you have the law of large numbers, you can deal with it. And then the final point that you raise on the issue of adequacy of sums insured. This too, I feel, should be more proactive from the insurer's side and the insurance sector side. In other words, where the intermediaries and the brokers reside, for those who know, to advise in a timely manner as opposed to letting things sit like that. And when the event happens and people like Mahesh go out to have a look, we then have to give the bad news that, listen, there's underinsurance here, average applies, and then all things just fall apart. I mean, the industry just does itself a disservice. And you lose all manner of trust that we've been building over decades, just gets eroded overnight. And I don't know why it is that we do that to ourselves. So I would appeal for that better understanding on this matter as we move forward.
But perhaps it's worth us actually discussing then, you know, is there such a thing as a general standard PVT insurance cover? You know, what does it cover? And you know, what sort of events does it cover? Because perhaps there's an opportunity there for you, Kaz, to actually explain some of that. And also, I'm really interested in the motor side of this conversation, because I seem to remember after 9/11 that the loss of cars around that event was one of the biggest events for the US motor insurance market for some time, because there were so many cars destroyed. So they actually did pay out on the vehicles. So, I mean, that's obviously my ignorance too. I don't quite understand if you have a PVT policy, you know, or if you don't have a policy, if the Westgate had a policy, why didn't it cover the cars that were in the car park regardless of who actually owned the cars?
Well, the answer to that is very simple. Their liability policies on this would exclude such kind of damage or destruction. What they would have is you walk into the mall at your own risk, and then it says if anything happens, which is our responsibility, we'll take it. On this particular one, the liability policies would not respond because there's a specific exclusion for terrorism.
So as Joe Public driving into a shopping mall, I wouldn't have understood that. I wouldn't understand that I need to have terrorism cover on my car if I'm going to take it into a supermarket car park where there may be a risk of an event, or drive it to an airport where there's all, you know, which is also a high risk zone, isn't it? That's complete ignorance on my part, I have to admit.
Very true, Liz. Because what happened here is a lot of people didn't know about these things. But yeah, I'll give an example. For the terrorism cover for Westgate, the additional premium that was offered, it was there, but nobody looks at it because nobody thinks about it. And I agree entirely with Carson. I'll go back to one practical example I had on how a properly written policy helps the clients. So what has happened in this particular case, the premium on that extension was about in US dollars, which is the easiest way to convert it, was about $30 per annum. Very, very few people had that. And they lost the cars, which were worth tens of thousands of dollars. But nobody knows about it. And as Carl said correctly, the insurance industry, the intermediaries, should be in a position to explain that to the clients, put it down in simple terms. Because one of the things which I find very frustrating and very annoying in my work is the small print that nobody reads, nobody takes notice of, and it falls on me to say, guys, please have a look at this. What do you want me to do? And that's when all hell breaks loose. But one point that Cass has mentioned about simply writing the policies, I must say I had a pleasant surprise recently when I was doing a significant claim for a multinational British-based company where they had a problem here. And when the PVT policy was produced, it actually listed down in simple terms what is covered and the description of what the peril is. So this particular one, there was a workers' strike, riot, theft of property, and some damage. So initially, we looked at it under a different policy, but when this one came in, it was a very simple matter to tell the insurance company everything is payable, your policy does not exclude anything, and the broadening of the cover previously, for example, in Westgate. In Westgate, they gave a settlement based on the cash value of the property that was damaged. So a simple example would be if you had a computer which is 2 years old and the current cost is, say, $2,000, but 2 years old is only $500, so you got paid $500. Now, the current policies are, if it's $2,000, we'll look at the current price of a similar model and pay you that, so it might be $1,500. So here, the policyholder is not too much out of pocket and he gets value for the money he's paid. So those changes are coming, but I don't know if all the insurance companies have the same policy. This one I saw, I was very impressed with it, because the only thing it carried was a deductible, which is for smaller claims or whatever. But I think we had a happy client, happy broker, happy insurer, everything was fine. But I cannot speak about this for all of them, please. So I got to be careful here.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because as a consumer of insurance, that's one of the most frustrating things, is if you buy a policy, something exactly as you said, you know, you have your computer stolen or whatever, and then it's devalued by the insurance company and you can't afford a new computer, so you're just a loser because that computer was perfectly usable. You would have carried on using it for the next 2 years perhaps, but now you're seriously out of pocket despite having an insurance policy. And I think a lot of consumers get confused by that and frustrated, and it does destroy trust, doesn't it? So it sounds like your one insurer needs to be hailed as a shining example. I don't know, Kaz, what do you think? Do you think that, you know, you clearly are frustrated by this as well?
No, I think it comes down to making your intentions well known. And too often we hide behind the legalese, if I may use that word. And I think that's unfair. More so for us on the continent, where we are trying to penetrate the insurance penetrations are exceptionally low. So these matters have to be explained. We're doing ourselves a disservice because many a time you look at the country revenue streams from an economic perspective of the insurance sector and you don't see much growth. And there should be. So I think that's our opportunity. And I would appeal that as people hear us or think about these matters, that we take it upon ourselves to make very clear the extent of coverage and what the conditions are and spell it out. Now, PVT on the subject we're dealing with is one of those controversial items. The definitions need to, it's all over the world, we'll start playing with the definitions. I tell you that, depending on the circumstances. And so I would say, even here as an example, by the way, if you take a local tribal authority and there's an uprising against that tribal authority, is that political? Does it take on and enter the realms of terrorism? And so we have that kind of debate. And of course, those debates always arise depending on the wording and how we feel we may want to extricate ourselves from the coverage, depending on the extent of the loss or the circumstances. And so I think we must be much clearer and, if needs be, on affordability, then spell out the limits. Which, by the way, Liz, post-July South Africa, the riots, SASRIA, which is the entity that provides the necessary cover, South African Special Risk Insurance Association, reduced the limit. There used to be a riot rep which took you right up to about 1.5 billion rands. The primary layer is 500 million rands, which is only about $30 million. So it wasn't much. So they've kept it at that. And then the premium rates, I think on the fire side, went up quite significantly, 50-60%. And on the vehicles, I think it went up significantly. So things have changed, yeah.
Mahesh, do you agree with that, generally speaking?
I think he's quite right. I agree with him entirely because he speaks from the insurance perspective. And I look at the loss adjusting side. And two of the fundamental problems I find is the adequacy of the underwriting of the policy, the clarity of the policy, the advice and the information passed on by the intermediary to the policyholders. It's always been, as far as I know, areas of conflict. And then again, as Cass correctly mentions, you see, when you have a tribal issue going on, that's not terrorism, that's not political. And when you try and argue that it is a civil commotion, again, that will be disputed by the insurer on the description of what it is. So right now, what happens in all this, in all the situations, is that somebody has suffered a loss, somebody has a policy, and somebody may be out of business because they're not going to be compensated because of the interpretation of the fact of the incident with the policy cover. So the simplicity is what Cass is suggesting. And as I go back to the same policy I was looking at last week, the clarity on that was unquestionable. There was no debate. There's nothing. Everything is spelled out. So even a layperson understands where their position lies. And that may not be forthcoming from what I can see. But the tendency of the insurance industry is just to circulate the same thing that goes on for decades and years. New writings, new contracts, new wordings, new terms and conditions are thought about but never implemented. There's one reason for that. And the one reason is the premiums. But there's a lot of competition. The industry has got too many players. And to look for that business, they go into cutting premiums. And you cut the premiums, when the claim comes in, you will find an excuse not to pay. Now, let's be fair. Any insurance claim can be paid if you want to be correct about it, or it can be declined if you want to be correct about it. So how you deal with it is how much empathy you have, how much understanding of the facts you have, and how broadly are you going to take the circumstances against what the policy covers. Now, this is where, as you correctly pointed out earlier, the insurance industry loses its trust from the policyholders. And the ability to impart this knowledge in Africa is a bit difficult because it's a poor continent.
I was thinking that you've left us with a very clear call to action for the insurance industry. You know, clarity is key on this. But I am afraid that that is all that we've got time for today. We will be back without a shadow of a doubt. So I just need to thank everyone for listening. And please let us know what you think. You can email us at info@continental-re.com. And if you found today's episode interesting, please tell a friend, mention us on social media, but above all else, do share the conversation. Thank you very much indeed.